car before the repo appeared on my credit report. Up until just a couple of years ago, anytime I played Canada, I'd get stopped by U.S. Customs when I was coming out. Looks like you had some problems coming from Canada in the past. No, 20 years ago, you stole my fucking car coming from Canada. You have a problem. That I'm just doing my job bullshit went out with the Nazis. Take responsibility for your actions. We were spending money faster than it was coming in. We'd get a stockpile and then just stop work until it ran out. The rent was consistently late and our landlord, Mr. Minas, was harassing us daily. And we made his life miserable. The thermostat for the entire building was in my first floor apartment, and he was adamant that it never go above 68 degrees. We'd crank it up to 85 and open the windows during the day in the winter. He'd come by and knock on the office door. While I let him in, Mikey would run down the back steps, go through the back door of the first floor apartment, and turn it down to 68. Meanwhile, I'd be assuring Mr. Minas that it was set at 68 while fumbling to find the keys to prove it. By the time we get down there, sure enough, it's set at 68 degrees. I don't know how many times we had a worker come over to check the broken thermostat. Mr. Minas was the only impression I was ever able to do spot on, and I'd fuck with our pothead upstairs neighbor on the third floor relentlessly.
Hello, Bruce. It's Mr. Minas. I was just by the apartment and I smelled something funny coming from underneath the door.
Just fucking with you. It's Doug. When the rent went unpaid, we always had some elaborate excuse for Mr. Minas when a simple one would have worked just as easily. There was some Chinese trade embargo on our goods for our import-export business. The orders are lined up, but we can't fulfill them until they release our product from customs at the shipping yard in San Ysidro, and that could be any day now. Don't blame us. Blame this Republican administration. So long as he believed we were on the precipice of a fat check, he would warily let us slide. Meanwhile, we're wondering, why do we live in Massachusetts at all? Rent was really expensive, winter sucked ass, and the truth is we can do this from anywhere they have a phone line. Why are we doing it here? And it only took so many afternoon cocktails to make this hypothetical into an absolute when we finally, literally, threw a dart at a map. Didn't hit Idaho exactly. It hit somewhere in Wyoming where there was no town, maybe not even a phone. But it was close enough to Idaho, and Idaho sounded funny. I called the Chamber of Commerce in Boise and drunkenly asked what rents were like. And she starts to refer me to real estate people. And I said, no, just what do you pay for rent? And she said, well, I pay $400 a month, but that's for a 4-bedroom house. And with that, we were moving to Idaho. Just like getting married, I committed to the joke. And these were the drunk dials I delighted in calling mother with out of nowhere. Hey, Ma, we're moving to Idaho. She was never surprised and always highly entertained. Her spontaneity pretty much flatlined with her move to Florida and her third marriage, but she could live vicariously through mine. And the fact that we had just watched the movie Moving with Richard Pryor together, where he gets transferred to Boise fucking Idaho, made it funnier still. Stan Cohen's marriage was on the rocks, and he, also drunk with us that day, threw his hat in the ring. I told his wife that it would be okay, he'd probably be back, that this was just a phase, the shit you're supposed to say. Jeff Brown was out. His wife didn't have a sense of humor about Idaho, and it didn't sound like an easy place to score blow. So our plan was set that Stan and Dory would go out on point to Idaho as soon as possible to secure a place to live and an office to rent. Mikey and I would pack up the office, get movers, tie up all the loose ends, and then we'd drive out to meet him. Mr. Minas could eat shit on the 3 months of back rent we owed him on each apartment. The apartments now became an ongoing party for anyone who was still left, which was everyone I went to school with who was still hanging around on the corner years later drinking out of a brown paper bag. Of all these people, Rufus was a legend. That wasn't his real name. Nobody's really named Rufus, but we'd called him that for so long we couldn't even remember why. He'd always been a leech and a ne'er-do-well, always with a sad story and broke, save for the pill organizer of his mother's medications he'd often steal. He didn't even know what they were most of the time. He'd just take them. But this night, Rufus showed up with something to offer. It was the first time I did ecstasy. He had it in powder form, and he'd twist it up into little hunks of toilet paper to make it sort of a pill. In no time, I loved everything and everybody. I even loved Rufus. More importantly, I loved my friend Stan's jilted wife, hanging around so hurt and vulnerable. If there's such a thing as making love, and there isn't, that's what I did with Stan's wife that night, without any remorse or guilt, at least until I was no longer on ecstasy. We never spoke about it again.
Chapter 10, Boise, fucking Idaho. Word came from Idaho that Dory and Stan had secured a small office and a huge spread in the hills of Boise, just underneath Idaho's billionaire potato magnate's mansion, J.R. Simplot, who had the contract to McDonald's French fries. It was the Idaho equivalent of living next to Steven Spielberg in L.A. I said Idaho equivalent. The movers had our shit on the way, so Mikey and I loaded up my brand new Ford Escort wagon with Otis, the four cats, and the parakeet, and took turns driving nonstop from Worcester to Idaho in 48 hours. The first thing that happened when we arrived was that the parakeet escaped. I should have taken it as a sign, canary in a coal mine. The new digs were outrageous. Three bedrooms that it seemed like you'd need a shuttle bus to travel between. Keep in mind, this is all in relation to what I'd experienced. If I were in that house today, maybe it would just be a really nice house. But back then, it was the Playboy Mansion. Every bedroom had a jacuzzi bathtub. The 10-piece sectional looked small in the place. Stan looked shaken. He wasn't one to take chances like this, and it showed in his face that he didn't want to be here. He just didn't want to be the one that chickened out. Dory was still expecting me to pay attention to her when I had all this shit to do. She was fighting with me from the minute the parakeet disappeared. I tended not to fight back and ignore her, but it was difficult. After one blowout argument that had everyone in the house on edge, I retreated to my big jacuzzi for a bubble bath and a beer. This was way fancier than our old arguments. Stan came into the bathroom in what appeared to be an attempt to smooth things over. "It's funny, you get along so well with my wife, and I get along so well with yours. We should just switch wives." "Fuck that," I announced, still angry. "You can just have my fucking wife." And with that, Dory was with Stan. I had no idea that this had been already in the works, or that Stan had been semi-serious with his comments in the bathroom. He'd been fucking my wife not minutes after I fucked his wife. The nerve! Now he was in the bathroom talking about taking her away for good, and I thought he was kidding around. He just walked out and told Dory that he'd talked to me and I was cool with it. I didn't even know what was going on. I woke up and my wife had left me, but only moved across the hallway. It'd be a week before they could get their shit together and go back to Massachusetts. It could have been far more uncomfortable, but I was fortunate that I'd learned from my dad how to ignore unpleasantness and smile when everything is falling down around you. I took Dory an hour or so north to the mountains to some natural hot springs and tried to talk her back, but it was too late. It was over. Mikey couldn't handle the stress in the house and went back to Vegas at his first opportunity. Dory was in a bind now because neither her nor Stan had any money, and they knew better than to ask me for any. Just before she left, Dory called her mother for a loan. It was the first time in a year and a half I'd seen her call anybody from her past. Within 2 weeks of showing up in Boise, I was now alone in this monstrous estate full of abandoned furniture and belongings without a friend in the world except Otis and the cats. I didn't work. I won tickets on the radio to see a cover band on my birthday, not knowing that it was something that anyone who called in won. I went and nobody talked to me. I joined a dating service, something only old people did back then. I called my first escort service. She wasn't a looker, but she wasn't in a hurry. She told me that she'd been on the Boise Vice Squad until she found out how much money escorts made and switched teams. I was depressed as fuck. I even joined AA again for just a minute until I let some AA douche come into my house and he helped me by dumping out all my booze down the sink. I wasn't that into AA, sir. Relax. I told the landlord the truth about the unexpected collapse around me. I told him that I wouldn't be able to afford to stay there. He reminded me that there was a lease agreement. I reminded him about the Supreme Court ruling in the old case of Blood versus Stone. I should have just given him the numbers to talk to my previous landlords. He should just be happy his dishes weren't at the bottom of a pool with cat shit in his closets. I stumbled on some real estate magazine and saw a cabin up in Garden Valley, Idaho, on the South Fork of the Payette River, right up where Dory and I had gone to the hot springs. It said that owner financing was available. It was for sale for $45,000, with payments of around $400 a month. I jumped on it and signed yet another agreement. Before I left Boise, I got that first phone bill. On it, I saw the phone call Dory had made to her mother. I had to know. I called her mother, who, after I explained whom I was, went straight into a tone of warning. Did she tell you how old she is? Turns out that had been the only thing Dory told me that was true. Everything else was completely invented. The 12 siblings? Nope, she was an only child. Even the name she'd claimed was her maiden name turned out to be taken from a stepfather who disowned her. I'd been POW'd, but unlike Wendell, she'd invented a relatively uneventful fantasy life, which is far stronger bullshit. Never give him a reason to fact check. I called Stan and tried to warn him about it, but she convinced him I was just making up bullshit to try to sabotage their relationship out of jealousy. He was in love and didn't want to believe it, and wouldn't until she left him 2 years later, taking his car and bouncing his checks all the way back to that same old boyfriend, now somewhere in Alabama. I also did my first open mic night at a comedy club before I left Boise. I always remember trying to be funny throughout my life. I was always a fan of stand-up comedians, but I honestly don't remember any serious ambitions to be one before then, any more than a fan of rock and roll daydreams about being Mick Jagger. I only did open mic in Boise as a cathartic opportunity to write and perform stupid and universally unfunny jokes about my now ex-wife. I was now 22 and looked at least 17, and marriage material coming out of me came across as out of place as a veiny erection on an infant. My jokes sucked, nobody bought it, and I still don't count it as my first time doing comedy. Same as I don't count Maura as losing my virginity when we were 9. It didn't really count as doing comedy until I was old enough to come. So I was off to the mountains. There were two names to my new town of 400-odd full-time residents. Crouch, Idaho was where the bar was located, and Garden Valley was down the street where the post office sat. Evidently, they're technically different, but considered to all be the same thing by the locals. It didn't matter. I was from Crouch. I was from the bar. And if moving to Idaho was funny, moving to Crouch, Idaho was funnier. It was soon apparent to both me and the pets that we were far outmatched for mountain life. One of the first mornings in the cabin, I woke up to Otis going crazy, barking like he was in a fight. I jumped out of bed and realized that he was only at the top of the stairs of the loft, barking at the open front door of our cabin. He was seeing what I was seeing, the biggest dog ever, a deer hanging around just a couple feet outside the cabin door. We didn't know that was, quote, normal. The next night I came home to the cats in the loft on either side of the box spring on the floor with something pinned behind it. I pulled out the bed and saw what I thought was a mouse until it started to fly. It was a goddamn bat. At this point in my life, all I knew about bats were rabies and vampires. There was no jack set up in the cabin yet, so the only way I could make phone calls was to plug my phone into the external jack outside the back door. I called Mother and Mike. Who the fuck else am I going to call? He's a cop, for Christ's sake, and they're supposed to know what to do in any situation, and she is my goddamn mother. They laughed their balls off at me as I'd make different forays in to trap it, fail, and call back. I still had the birdcage from the parakeet and tried to use a spatula to fling it from the wall into the cage. I missed, and it went launching around the room again. Eventually, it landed on a support beam way up in the ceiling and stayed there. I fell into bed, exhausted, and figured we'd call it even. You stay on your side, I'll stay on mine. And as soon as I lay down and put my hand under my pillow, something scurried through my already nerve-racked hand, and I leapt like I'd touched electricity. Turned out it was only a lizard, but it was too much. I would have fled in the middle of the night like the Lutz family in the Amityville Horror if I had any place to go. The only other place to go was the bar.
The bar in Crouch was called the Dirty Shame, where they let me know early on that they had a history of holding down hippies and cutting off their long hair. I knew this probably hadn't happened in decades, if at all, but I played along just for fun. The owners were a divorced couple, Ron and Jolene Jensen, who traded shifts. Jolene was a saint to me, and she took me under her wing. Ron, not so much. Most of the regulars were grizzled and taciturn mountain men in Wrangler jeans with perma frowns. I was the goofy long-haired kid that found the few rock and roll songs on the jukebox and banged them out repeatedly. I was the weirdo who ate moths collected outside the neon beer sign for attention when I was drunk. I was the new guy who did that weird thing with his mouth. What's that called? Oh yeah, smiling. One of the regulars, who was rightfully even more unfriendly than the rest, was a burn victim that occupied the same seat most every day, drinking beer in a brooding silence, using his nubs like chopsticks to get the beer to his head, which had no ears. Rumor was that the guy was having an affair with Jolene when she was still married to Ron. According to lore, Ron had set his trailer on fire with him in it. Only the guy didn't die. Instead, he just sat there silently drinking every day at the bar, making Ron stare at the gruesome spectacle he'd created. That's some serious fuck you. That's some Stephen King shit right there. My father came up to visit with Gail. There had been great scandal, especially in the humdrum context of their lives. Their church had a female minister, and it had come to light that Gail had fallen in love with the minister's husband. They say don't shit where you eat, and Gail had taken a large looping pile right in the heart of my dad's safe place. He wasn't religious necessarily, but he always immersed himself in the social functions at church, serving senior lunch, teaching Sunday school. He'd been a deacon, whatever that means, but it meant something to him. Gail pulling some shit like this was a dagger and a humiliation. Still, Dad had coerced her into taking this vacation since they already planned it and already paid for it. He thought it maybe he still had a chance to save it, like when I brought Dory up here to the hot springs. Gail was a bit younger than Dad, and while they both loved the outdoors, Gail actually did stuff outdoors other than just stroll around and whistle. She was a pretty experienced whitewater rafter, and the Payette River was a decent spot for that. So my father, desperate to impress, booked us on an afternoon rafting. Dad had the agility of a giant drunk baby, and just watching him wobbling to get into the boat was cringe-inducing. The first and most important rule they told us was that when you hit the rapids, keep paddling. My dad was at the front left of the raft, and as soon as we hit whitewater, he did just the opposite and recoiled back into the raft like we were about to hit an iceberg. It was sad to watch him trying so hard to prove himself, to be something that he wasn't, just to hold on to a woman who'd just publicly disgraced him. Gail left my dad when they got back home. He took it like a Buddhist. If she were happier somewhere else, why would he want to interfere? He'd make the best of it. It'd all work out. I wish there was more of my dad in me. I was more like mother. I wished he'd just burned her alive in a trailer. I had the phone set up at the cabin, but I didn't dial it very often. The Dirty Shame would open roughly around noon, very roughly, and most of the day I'd just drive back and forth waiting for Jolene to show up and unlock the place so I could start drinking. My bar tab was enormous by now, and they were looking to repo my car for non-payment. Good luck finding it up here. Mikey came back up to Idaho now that all the drama was done and got straight to work in not working at all with me. There was some fun to be had. That summer, the military were doing some kind of war game exercises in the mountains around Crouch. And a few of them came into the bar one afternoon, and Mikey and I end up talking to these guys. So after a few beers, they had to head back to camp. And we drove them as far as the roads would take them before they jumped out to hike the rest of the way. Later, we got drunk and thought it would be funny to try to infiltrate their camp. We drove to where we had dropped them off, armed with flashlights, beer, a paintball gun, and our faces blackened with burnt cork just for effect, and we started hiking. And after a half an hour or so, we heard whispers and realized we're right smack dab in the middle of their camp. Not knowing what to do next, we just chimed up, told them we were local rebels, and asked them if they wanted a beer. One of the guys got into some shit for taking the ride earlier and giving away their position, but eventually we were designated local friendlies and had a few of the guys stationed at our cabin for a couple of days as part of the war games. Here and there, we'd get to drive them to a bridge that they had to blow up with non-existent explosives. Mostly, we just hung around the cabin, them giving us souvenirs like freeze-dried food rations and us giving them shitloads of beer. Later, their exercises got the blame, at least locally, for starting a forest fire that nearly forced the evacuation of the entire valley. You didn't have to burn us out of Crouch. The complete dearth of single women did that naturally. We had a drinking buddy couple named Roy and Kathy Bunce. They were late-stage death row alcoholics. Roy had had 13 tons of steel dropped on him at a work site years back, and now was toothless with a dented skull and the speech pattern of a deaf person. Kathy would get so intoxicated that she'd walk home just across the street from the bar with her pants all the way down, pissing as she stumbled. Good-hearted, salt-of-the-earth folk. They had a 13-year-old daughter named Kalina, nicknamed Baby. One day, me and Mikey noticed that Baby had tits, and when we started doing the math on how long before she turned 18, we decided we better get the fuck out of this town. I'd heard that one of the Vegas phone rooms had opened a new room in Eugene, Oregon, so I figured I'd try that out before I caved in and headed back to Nevada. I lasted 3 days. There was no star treatment like I'd earned in Las Vegas, and I couldn't even score an advance on my commission. The only memory I have from that trip was sitting in a titty bar called Jiggles, waiting for the World Series to start when the San Francisco earthquake struck and canceled the game, one of the few exciting moments ever in baseball history. So around October 17th, 1989, I went back to close up the cabin, give back the keys, and head for Las Vegas. Vegas had been the only place so far that ever really paid off for me, so we headed back. I gave my washer and dryer, as well as a lot of other small appliances, to Jolene in trade for my bar tab. Not an unusual occurrence at the Dirty Shame. My furniture, including that good old 10-piece sectional, went to the Bunces. I packed what would fit my car, along with Otis and now 3 cats. My cat mother had died in Idaho. I don't know how. She was just sluggish one day and dead the next. Like most parents of children, I was in no position to have pets anyway.
Chapter 11, Vegas Redux. 14 hours later, I was back in Vegas. I showed up at the door of a girl I'd known from AA named Rachel. I loaded the animals into her place and we got into her hot tub drinking beer. That AA baloney hadn't worked for her either. She asked me if I wanted a pill. I can't remember if it was a Quaalude or a Valium, but I'd never fucked with pills, so I said yes. I had another beer, and the next thing I knew, I woke up on her couch 14 hours later. I slept as long as I'd driven. One of my cats had escaped and never came back. The remaining two went off somewhere not long after, and I'm ashamed to say I can't remember how or where. But pretty quickly, it was just me and my dog, Otis. Otis was a brilliant dog, and it wouldn't be until I got stupid dogs years later that I realized it was his natural intelligence, not my dog training abilities. In Idaho, I could tell him, Otis, go get your ball out of the car. And he'd jump off the couch, run outside and through the open car window, into the back seat, bringing back his tennis ball. He'd instinctively go for your balls when you were roughhousing with him, and eventually I trained him to do it on command. Bite nads, Otis, and he'd nip you in the nuts. It was a great party trick. People believed your German Shepherd was trained to rip their balls off. They didn't know he was only trained to bite the person that said it. I found a room to rent in a house that should have been condemned, or maybe was, from a hardcore heroin addict, spindly and emaciated with shards of rotted black teeth. It was way on the outskirts of the city limits in the desert on East Charlton Boulevard. The house was on what appeared to be a junkyard, with the junkie living in a trailer in the back. It was straight out of The Hills Have Eyes. Very little of the plumbing worked. All of the common areas were covered in dust. If you've ever seen those remnants of houses they used in nuclear blast testing in Nevada, you get an idea. The other guy renting a room in the house was a guy working as a booking agent for a local rock and roll club. The rare times he was there, he carried a befuddled look on his face, as if wondering what wrong turn in life wound him up here. He and the junkie had sat me down when I initially told them I wanted the room. They hemmed and hawed before explaining to me that the last tenant in that room had shot himself in the head in the bed. The bullet hole was still in the wall. They were relieved when I thought that was funny. It had good story value, and the room was only $65 a week, with Otis having full run of the junkyard. Dogs don't understand the word squalor. It was perfect. American Distributing had lost the grudge from my customer abuse departure of 2 years previous and welcomed me back like a hero, mostly because sales were sucking shit. Nevada had by now instituted more regulations and you had to get photographed and fingerprinted to be licensed as a salesman. Just taking out the people who had warrants would gut your sales force by half. The office was a ghost town. Thankfully, Tom Konopka was still there, and we picked up where we'd left off as a telemarketing comedy team. Hey, Tom, get this. This morning at breakfast, my dog said, in the creation of comedy, it is paradoxical that tragedy stimulates the spirit of ridicule, because ridicule, I suppose, is an attitude of defiance. We must laugh in the face of our helplessness against the forces of nature, or go insane. That's a very astute dog. That's what I thought at first. Turns out he stole it from Charlie Chaplin. Fucking plagiarist dog, I said, having just read the quote out of the newspaper. I made pretty good money still, but now that I was legitimately over 21, I was able to indulge in mother-like gambling binges with no threat of being thrown out. I'd regularly leave work on Friday at noon, cash my check, and head directly across the street to the 7-card stud table at the Circus Circus. I'd play poorly for 13 to 14 hours sometimes until I was drunk and every penny was gone, knowing the junkie landlord was jumping from foot to foot waiting for my rent so he could shoot up. I'd have to pawn things to pay him, my paintball gun, my VCR. I even set up another yard sale that, like the last, became 24/7 when I was too lazy to clean it up. I'd call mother after marathon runs and sleepless nights on a roulette wheel to commiserate. I'd sometimes use suicide as a mental option for whether or not I should cash in the rest of my money for one more hand or another spin. If I lose it all, I can always kill myself. It was comforting to have that out. I saw how she'd gambled and wondered if she'd ever thought the same. Calling someone as fucked up as you always leads to diffusing laughter. You don't call your doctor when you have a hangover. You call your drunkard friends. The only reason that people on the TV show Intervention get intervened upon is that they don't stick with their own kind. I lost all my money once playing bingo. Bingo was great when you were broke because you could play for an hour on $3 minimum cards and you'd drink all you could drink for free. In between games, I'd play nickel slots and drink for free for an hour until the next game. It takes a long time to blow a paycheck that way, but somehow I managed. I'd go home and call mother, an avid bingo player herself, and we'd complain about bingo. These were conversations you're supposed to have when you're both elderly. Mother would put Mike on the extension and we'd bullshit and ball bust until the depression turned into gut laughs. The gambling losses, the suicide rental room in the junkyard, the junkie landlord doing the cool jerk waiting for his $65. I was talking in comedy routines without realizing it. We were both really into watching stand-up and would always trade recommendations. It was rubbing off. She told me, you should do stand-up comedy. You're funnier than any of these pricks on TV. I told her, I'm only funny like this when I'm overtired. That'd never work. Hey, Doug, you should get some sleep. I can't. I have a gig on Wednesday. I fell in mad love for a week with one of the few women who ever worked the phones at American. Her name was Victoria, and she was a scary, impetuous drunk and drug fiend. The kind that thought it was funny to steal someone's car at a company party and joyride it to go find coke. She'd come in hungover one morning, having got married in a blackout to one of the other salesmen, but unlike me, wasn't sticking with the joke. I got her back to my hovel that night, and she stayed for a week trying to ditch her new husband, who'd taken it all too seriously. He was coming undone at the office since her disappearance. I swore to him I had no idea where she was. She loved the desperation of my rat hole and couldn't get enough of the sketchy, junk-strung landlord. She gave me her wedding ring on a necklace. Before she left my place to move back to Phoenix, she left me a note saying, "When I am on the cover of Rolling Stone and being interviewed, I will ask you, Doug Stanhope, to present yourself in my life again, and then I want my wedding ring back." I didn't bother getting a subscription, but I kept the note. One day I came back to the Spawn Ranch and found a 3-day eviction notice. Seems the junkie hadn't been giving whoever owned the place any of that rent money after all. I confronted him, and he just shrugged it off with, "What did you expect, man? I'm a junkie." It was the parable of the scorpion and the frog. He was a junkie, and therefore it was his nature. Or, as Mikey would have said, just 'cause. Meanwhile, I'd been dating, banging a girl named Pandora Tranowski, a seamstress who also worked part-time as a hostess at an S&M dungeon. I'd been set up on a blind date with her, and it was very casual. But now that I was out on my ass, I conveniently wanted to take it to the next level. Otis and I moved in with her, and while the sex was kinky, once I'm finished, you're no longer a dominatrix. Now you're just a bitch. It's fine shoving something up my ass while we're fucking, but as soon as I'm done, I have my own shit to do, and bleaching the toilet isn't it. There was a 24-hour bar and grill right by her apartment that I'd eat breakfast at every day. It was summer, so I'd let Otis hang in the shade outside the front door. He was a smart dog. He wouldn't run off. One morning, some guy leaving the bar spotted him out front and came back in asking everyone at the bar if anyone owned him. I was on the restaurant side and hadn't heard him. The guy took off with Otis before I ever knew he'd asked. I was frantic. I left my number with the bartender. I put an ad in the classifieds. It was June 24th, 1989. I still remember distinctly. Or maybe it was the 28th.
Actually, it was 1990. Someone found the error and pointed out my fucked up timeline. It was right before I started stand-up comedy in 1990. But I definitely remember that it was the 24th. Or it could have been the 28th. I'll never forget.
I checked in with the bar several times a day to no avail. And then, a few days later, my phone rang, and it was the guy who had my dog. I couldn't believe it. I'd given up. I told him what a great dog he was, how smart and kind he was, all the different tricks he could do. We made arrangements to meet at another bar that night to pick him up. In my excitement, I forgot to ask for his number. I must have oversold what a great dog he was because the guy never showed up and I never saw Otis again. Bite nads, Otis. Bite nads.
This next chapter, imagine me reading it with my penis out, all flaccid half the distance of my balls. And resume. Chapter 12, Stand-Up Comedy. I don't remember why, but around that time I left American Distributing for another job at a place called the Tower Group. The scam was credit card protection, and the big prize was another worthless vacation. I was disinterested in working on autopilot. Andrew Dice Clay had just broken big, and I knew his album by heart, so I'd parroted around the office anytime I wasn't on the phone. The owner of the company was this stout, mustachioed rugby player. His name was Buzz, and he'd see me getting all these laughs doing dice material around the office. Anytime I wasn't on the phone, I was doing dice. So he offered me a gig opening for his band, and I knew that it was wrong. I said, "That's not my material. That's this new guy, Andrew Dice Clay."
And he didn't give a fuck. He said, I don't care. He's the owner of a fraud telemarketing operation. Of course he doesn't care. He doesn't have a lot of scruples. But even back then, I know it's wrong. But just the idea that I could get a gig if I had my own material got me to start writing. I found an open mic at a bar called the Escape Lounge 2 on Maryland Parkway. I'd go every week and I'd watch the comedians, always asking if I could go up the next week. I'd go home afterwards and I'd spend all week writing down jokes, premises, even just funny words. Sea monkeys was funny to me, so I wrote a horrible bit around that just to be able to say sea monkeys. And then I'd get on the phone and try all my material out with Mother. Every week I'd go back, and Ron Putnam was this big, fat, sweet, tender guy that ran the open mic. And every week he'd ask me, are you ready to go up? And I never was. And it became a running joke every time I'd see him. You ready to go up? Nope. So I'd watch the show, go home, write some more. Pandora started to hate me. I wasn't getting shit done around the house. I wasn't making much money at the time because all of my headspace was going into writing more jokes. And next week, I'm going to go up. And finally, August 28th, 1990, I put my name on the list. Pandora and her mother, who was visiting from California, were in tow. I finished most of a pitcher of beer before I went up. That doesn't work for everyone, but it did for me. And I killed. This isn't to say that I was any good, but it's common in stand-up for comics to do well their first time and then eat shit for months or years afterwards. Your first time, you have comics to play to, and comics are generally supportive of one another and usually root hard for first-timers. Once they've already heard it, though, you're dead. So as much as I hate the cliche, comedy is like a drug in that you're always chasing that initial high, which is never as good. And also, like a drug, it will eventually wear you down and ruin you. It'll destroy your relationships. It'll make you drift away from your old friends in favor of new friends who are doing your comedy drug, still chasing the dragon. After a time, you don't even enjoy the drug anymore, but you keep doing it out of habit. It's all you know. It's also a gateway drug that if you stick with it long enough, it might lead you into harder drugs like sitcoms. You can see how deep you've fallen into the abyss. You want to go back to who you were, but it's too late. The withdrawals of going back to a 40-hour work week. No, I can't handle it. I got the shakes. That's too much to bear. And then you get shunned from the circles when you get too sloppy at your drug and they have no more use for you. You're no longer wanted. Open Mic Tuesday. Go ahead, sign yourself up. 1990 was still at the tail end of the 80s comedy boom, and there were plenty of bars to do open mic. After my first night's success, local open micers put me up everywhere. I did 6 shows at different bars in my second week of comedy. I had no idea that I sucked. Like growing up, you don't realize how stupid you were till years later. Besides, everyone else sucked as much or worse than I did, so it was all relative. I'm sure a lot of the problem was that I'd worked all of this material out with my mother, and she'd laugh at everything. Even on her deathbed, she'd bring up old bits from my open mic days like naked baby pictures. Most were truly embarrassing, but she'd repeat them as though they were comedy classics. Remember that bit about the used car salesman working the drive-thru? Do you want fries with that? What's holding you back from the fries? What's it gonna take to put you into some of these fries? Please, Ma, let it go. I fucking bet that's on Mike Upchurch's uploaded fucking YouTube video of my third month in comedy. I listened to 2 sentences. and went, I can't listen to this. I'll never be drunk enough. I will drink myself to death, leaving Las Vegas style before I can watch me 3 months into comedy. He said, you want me to take it down? I go, no, people should definitely see how bad everyone has to suck at the beginning. And that's why there's so few of us 25 years in. I hit comedy with the same timing I hit the phone rooms at the end of the boom. Everyone was making $5,000 back with the 1-4 pitch. And when I hit comedy, everyone was making $5,000 back in the 80s. I didn't give a shit. I never had eyes on making a living off doing comedy. It was just something to do to see if I could pull it off. And in a very short time, I was a big log in the small toilet of Las Vegas open mic comedy. Drinks were always free, and that's usually all you got. My first paying gig in town landed me a whopping $10, but that was a landmark night because getting paid any amount technically made me a professional. I could now, in good conscience, say that I was a traveling, formerly homeless, experienced male prostitute, con artist, turned drug smuggling mountain man, and a formerly recovered and then active alcoholic prone to interracial, transgender sexual interludes. I was keen on not being full of shit, if only technically. And I was quick to denounce myself on the technicalities once the joke was told, unlike serious bullshit comics I know today. But that night, I became a professional comedian. That fact I didn't consider a mere formality. It was real to me. I called my brother to tell him I'd officially turned pro in comedy. He asked me if that means I no longer had to wear the oversized gloves and protective headgear anymore. You funny fuck. I called Mother, too, to tell her about my new status. I couldn't have done it without her. Comedy was also getting me the eye from the ladies here and again. The same kind of girls you can score doing really good karaoke. Girls nonetheless. Things with Pandora and I were already strained, and the new female attention I was getting didn't help. This came to a head on the night of the Tower Group Company Christmas party. Somewhere in the night, I'd lost the keys to Pandora's car, and we had to get a ride home from another employee. Back at the apartment, she went into a full-blown rage. We ended up nose-to-nose screaming when she cocked back and punched me straight in the mouth. Never tell a woman that you would never hit a woman. Because they're going to store that knowledge. I dared her. Do it again, under threat of retaliation. And she didn't hesitate. She kept punching me in the head, not really my weak spot, especially when I'm full of alcohol, until I could restrain her, push her out the door, and lock it. I waited a couple of minutes for her to calm down until she assured me she was good, and I opened the door just enough for her to barrel through and resume punching me in the head. And then she went after my stuff, throwing things out into the street, one at a time, a toaster, a notebook, a pile of clothes. I called the police, and when the cops showed up, he walked in to assess the situation, and Pandora yelled, "He tried to kill me!" That's yet another reason that my go-to charity is the Innocence Project. It's pro bono lawyers and students fighting for the wrongly accused. I told the 911 operator that I just wanted to get my belongings out without violence, and I told the cop the same thing. He stood there trying to calm shit down while I'm carrying armloads of shit into my car, still wearing a tuxedo, bleeding from two split lips. Other than that, officer, it was a pretty good party. And that got a laugh, and that sent Pandora over the top, and she hurled a full unopened beer can at my head. So it destroyed her whole "he tried to kill me" story with the cop. I got my shit and I got the fuck out of there forever. I went out and found Ron Putnam and some local comics at a bar while the blood was still fresh. Most people will never know the beauty of the ball busting and laughs you can get out of being the victim of domestic violence. But most people will never be comedians. Sidebar! Before I started this book, I did an internet search for Pandora Tranowski. The first link I found was a series of mugshots out of Texas for drugs and prostitution arrests, each more disheveled than the next. It was like the faces of meth photos. The second link was her obituary. You should feel kind of bad in these situations, but sometimes you just don't. You can't force yourself. I found refuge on the couch at Mikey's place. The next few months were a montage of comedy, weird strippers, poor decisions, and leaving bars at 7 o'clock in the morning. I won a couple of comedy competitions at local bars and eventually got my first official road gig at Sandy Hackett's Route 66 Comedy Club in Flagstaff, Arizona, co-headlining with a ventriloquist act. The club was at the bottom of the Monte Vista Hotel, an old historic hotel where your bed would rattle every time the train went by across the street, which seemed like every few minutes. I only had to do 30 to 35 minutes, but with everything I'd ever written, including the "Do you want fries with that" diatribe that mother loved so much, it totaled about 25 at best, and I was scared. The puppet act was even more afraid. He'd never worked comedy clubs before, mostly just state fairs. He was neurotic as fuck. He wouldn't even stay in the hotel. He was afraid that due to the age of the hotel, that it might burn down and take his dummy with it. He told me that one time he worked a cruise ship and some drunk threw his dummy overboard, and that he'd rather pay for his own hotel than go through that trauma again. Welcome to the road, Stanhope. As if I wasn't nervous enough, Victoria had gotten in touch with me. She was living in Phoenix now and was going to come up to my show. That psycho fuck-up from American Distributing who had stolen my heart was going to be at my first road gig. I called Mother in Florida, again collect, and worked out as much ad-lib stuff about the hotel, the room, the train tracks, anything that could pad my time. All those lines killed, at least on the phone with Mother. On stage, they did better than my prepared novice act, but there was no epic victory by any stretch. I don't think I ever did more than 28 minutes, but nobody was clamoring for more. Victoria showed up, sober now, and I was in love again. She told me I should move to Phoenix with her. I didn't ask a lot of questions. I'd been driving Mikey out of his mind, living on his couch, and it was probably a good idea for me to live in a state that had last call on alcohol. But mostly, I just wanted to be in love over and over again. Of course, I called Mother after every show. She wanted to know how each bit that I'd riffed with her had gone over, like she was coaching me from a prison. And after the last show, I called again. How'd the show go? Great! I'm moving to Phoenix!
Chapter 13, Going Pro in Phoenix. When I showed up in Phoenix, Victoria was house-sitting for some rich dude in Scottsdale. I fell into a plush bed in a huge house, woke up to float in the swimming pool while she brought me breakfast, sharing the disgusting, dreamy-eyed bliss of being in love. Those were amazing days, about three of them. Then the dude came back and we moved in with her parents. In hindsight, I think her parents were more than tolerant of me being there, mostly because they were just happy she was staying sober and not around the drug addicts and enablers that she usually ran with. I was an up-and-coming goddamn stand-up comedian. That explained why my days of chain-smoking, drinking coffee, and reading newspapers at the dining room table could be written off as work. And that actually was the work. Pretty soon I got a job as the house MC at a local failing comedy club called the Comedy Cove inside the Days Inn Lounge in Phoenix. My pay was a free room, All the free food I could scam from the kitchen, and more stage time than you could ask for in those early years. Doing a full 10 to 15 minutes on stage, 7 days a week, every week in a regular comedy club, as opposed to open mic nights. The comedy clubs in Vegas never touched local acts. They got all their people from Los Angeles, so the open mic pool there was a stagnant pond of incest. You never met anyone who actually did this for a living. At one point, Ron Putnam hired a headliner from the Riviera to come down between shows and close the open mic at the Escape Lounge, trying to raise the image of the show. He got comedian Geechee Guy, who had just won Star Search, the America's Got Talent of the day. Geech got heckled and came back with the softest version of the most hackneyed comic comeback of all time. "Hey, I don't come down to where you work and unplug the Slurpee machine." The back of the room fell apart. The comics were dying laughing at the most overdone response in heckler history. We were so sequestered from actual working road comics that it was brand new to us. Even comics who'd been doing Vegas amateur comedy for years. In Phoenix, I now would be working with actual road comics every week as opposed to just the locals. I finally made contacts. I saw that I could actually do this for a living, and I worked my ass off, even if I didn't have any kind of voice. I don't even think I had opinions yet, but I wrote endlessly and I was immersed. And as I got more swallowed up in comedy, Victoria got back into coke and methamphetamine and some lighting guy for Cheap Trick. You follow your heart.
Director's commentary. The fucking lighting guy from Cheap Trick, really?
Yeah, I know. I say it all the time, really. I mean, he just called me, which is really weird because we don't talk. Probably about 3 months
ago. And you have a kid together.
Yeah, yeah. She doesn't talk because my son and her got in an argument and he told her, fuck you, so she doesn't talk to me either.
Did you go to a Cheap Trick concert?
No. Remember, Brian was staying in the Days Inn. He was doing a lighting gig for some morticians conference or some shit in fucking at the Phoenician. And Rick called me, you know, the bartender.
Rick was a bartender at the comedy club.
Yeah, the gay bartender.
Gay guy.
Yeah.
Which is the reason I ate.
Yeah.
I wasn't getting paid. I just got free room. And then I'd schmooze him for, he'd go to the kitchen and get me something to eat all the time.
We lived on cheese crisps at that fucking hotel, didn't we? Quesadillas or whatever you call them. Oh, yeah.
Pretty much.
Oh, yeah. And Rick calls me up and says, hey, there's this long-haired guy that keeps coming into the fucking bar. I think he's staying in the hotel and he's got an Aerosmith t-shirt on. You ought to come down and check him out, because he knew that you were kind of being a jackass at the time. So I'm like, oh, fuck. It was the first time I had a day off and I was working all three jobs. I'm like, fuck you, Rick. I'm not coming in. And I went in and ended up bullshitting with the guy and that was it. It was over. I was married.
That was it. It was done.
It's done.
So we have covered from when we met at American Distributing
in
the Vegas days.
Yeah, yeah.
And there literally was a company party where you took off in someone's car. I think it was one of the managers.
It was.
What was that Boston guy's name? I think he's dead.
Matt, because didn't he have testicle cancer?
Testicle cancer.
Yeah, and I smashed a guitar on somebody's head at that party, too.
You're out of control.
They just started me on new antidepressants, and then I got high on top of it all, so I just whacked out. Yeah.
You were just always out of control, but absolutely beautiful. No one could ever, like, give you shit. You were so funny and such a knockout that she stole my car, I guess.
You know, and I did that shit up here too. I steal people's cars and repark it because I was on, you know, I was high and they were high and I knew I could fuck with them, you know.
And when you say high, you're not talking about weed.
No. No, we were tweaking then, yeah.
But I remember the guy's name that you married.
John Valancourt.
Valancourt.
Oh, my God. I'll never forget that. Remember the buddy from American that he used to hang out with? He was like a goober, and they used to sit out in the desert and wait for UFOs on the weekend.
Oh, I don't know.
Oh, my God.
There was so many. I never really, we didn't get along that well.
The
Valancourt and I.
No, not at all. God, I had to send him to work one day, and then I moved back to Arizona.
Well, you stayed with me for a while.
Yeah, yeah.
You stayed out at the junkie house.
Yes, yes.
And you remember
Mike. Yes,
Methadone Mike. She remembers the name of the junkie from that Spawn Ranch out on
because
East
Because I turned
Charleston.
Into Methadone Mike eventually, doing my own shimmy.
Oh, that guy was, And when he finally, came home to an eviction notice, and he's just like, yeah, well, I don't pay the rent. I'm a junkie. What do you expect?
I know. But remember the 24-hour garage sale, and he had like a bunch of old games out there, Trash Monopoly and Risk.
Oh, that was mine. That was
yours?
Yeah, he put some stuff in it, but that was mine. That's in the book, the 24-hour yard sale.
Yeah.
Because when I moved back to Vegas and left again, we did the same thing at the other house.
Oh my God!
We're just too lazy to clean up the shit people didn't buy. When I called you during this book, like your life was just in complete fucking disarray.
Oh my God.
Your sister had died. You're working for a lawyer to pay a court cost.
Oh,
and your
yeah.
husband's in prison
for murder, no
for
less.
A cold case murder from like 30 years ago.
Fucking A, he was in the newspaper from Los Angeles to Podunk, Virginia. He was on the front page of the paper at my mom and dad's house.
But the thing is, you're telling me we hadn't talked in 10 years, maybe.
Yeah, probably.
And you're telling me all this shit, laughing the same way you're laughing now. And I always love that about you.
Because it's the same fucking chaos, different day. You know, it fucking is.
My doctor says he's never seen a junkie in this good of shape. A junkie for 30 years. The doctor's amazed.
Yeah, he did say that, actually. He said, when I went in to get on the Suboxone, actually, he said, it'd be a lot easier if you told me what you're not on. Yeah, those were the days.
Yeah, I don't know. Shit, I don't want to get ahead of myself if it's not in the book yet. No, we already talked about Pandora by now. I don't know if
I vaguely
there was
remember.
A girl that named Pandora that I think it was right after you moved back to Phoenix from Vegas that I started dating.
Yep.
And I looked up her up before the book came out.
Uh-huh.
And the first thing I found was one of those like Faces of Meth mugshot pages she was in.
No.
And the second one was her obituary.
Get the fuck out. Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
You think she OD'd?
I'm sure. She was in a lot of those. She was in Texas at the time, and there were multiple findings of her in mugshots, and it was just like the Faces of Meth where she's just deteriorating. And
that's too bad.
And prostitution arrests.
She was pretty, though.
No. Nah, not really.
All right.
She was all right, but she didn't lose.
She didn't get any better.
No.
God. Do you remember our trip, though, too? I was just telling my father-in-law about our trip to Florida. And when we ended up, they overbooked or something like that. And we stayed over in, I think it was Memphis. And we got a hotel and we got first class the next day to fly to your mom's house.
Oh, you've met my mom.
Of course I have.
I couldn't
she
remember.
Loves me. She loved me. Oh, yeah. I was around for the farts on tape, all that shit. Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Yeah,
absolutely.
Classical
gas. Yes, classical.
That's in the book.
Yeah, I know it. But do you remember that night we went to the fucking demolition derby? That's what they did in that little freaking town?
Yeah. Because her husband was...
Yeah, he was the sheriff or some shit. Yeah. Crazy Eights is what they call it.
Yeah, Sheriff Mike.
And then he took us out to the fucking swamp and turns his lights on, and all you seen was them eyes out there. It was all the gators.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah.
I'm pretty good for a junkie, though. I got a good memory, huh?
I should have called you more often about this book. Yeah, no, drugs are better for memory than alcohol.
I would imagine.
I still have nights where... I have vivid recollection because I was either tripping or doing cocaine.
Yeah.
If you just drink and take Xanax to go to bed, you fucking, it's all gone. I'm trying to remember. I have pictures of you and I with mother.
Mm-hmm.
You said something about coming from Memphis.
Yeah, because you and I, we were in Arizona, and I can't even remember the time frame. But you and I flew to meet your mom so that I could meet your mom. We talked on the phone for a long time. And I don't know how we managed to get tickets or something, but we got to Memphis was the layover, and they had overbooked. So we weren't in a hurry, so we volunteered to go the next day because we got first class the next day.
Oh, shit.
And we got put up in Memphis. But we're on the third fucking floor. Remember we had a mouse in our room? How the fuck does a mouse get on the third floor?
I don't remember any of this.
Oh, yeah, I flipped out. They put us in another room. Yeah. Yeah. That was a great trip. You know, I wasn't high then.
There's nothing worse than something like that happening in a free room.
I know.
Where you go, I can't get my money back. This would be such an easy way to get my money back.
I know. It's like you get the hair on the plate. Oh, you want something else? No, I don't want something else with another hair. Thank you.
But back then, anything. I mean, we were not flush by any means. We were broke. And getting a free hotel room, that would have been great. That was great.
And, you know, the first thing I did.
Surprised we didn't bring the mouse with us.
I know. But we had a great time in Florida. And then after the night of the demolition derby, we went to the local flea market. Remember that? Yep, you, me, the sheriff, and your mom.
With my mother, it was a life of thrift stores and flea markets, specific time doesn't ring a bell.
It was great. I had a blast.
Did we go to bingo with her?
I think we did.
I remember I found something when I was going through all of her shit to write the book. Where
I think we did.
It was talking about bingo. I went, wait, this predates my girlfriend's bingo.
Her
nickname is bingo. And I'm like, wait, we went... What's this about bingo? Did. No. We actually went to bingo
with
mother and...
You got kicked out. You got kicked out because you kept calling bingo and you didn't have a bingo. Do you remember that?
I remember this might have been Vegas. We used to do that a lot in Vegas.
Oh, yeah.
I wouldn't have
God.
Done that with my mother. She would have gone apeshit if I did that.
It must have been Vegas. It had to be. We hung out with Bo Greitz's kid in Las Vegas.
Yeah, Vegas.
And we drank cases of Meisterbrau. I know. It was like $6 a case or some shit.
Yeah.
And then we go to 99-cent dinners at all the off-the-strip little dives, remember?
Yeah, all the casinos, graveyard shift specials.
Oh, yeah.
The perfect place to be young and broke or even homeless.
It was great, yeah. I mean, 99 cents for a big-ass fucking plate of spaghetti? Come on.
Yeah, 49-cent breakfast at the Orleans, not the Orleans. It was something New Orleans related. It was off the strip. The Orleans is newer. But
God, that was great. God, I remember one time dropping you off at the airport. You're flying back to Vegas. And I was in Phoenix, and you were in Las Vegas before I even left the airport. Remember, I lost my fucking car? Remember that?
No.
Oh, my God. I was wandering up and down that spiral thing. It was the new airport. Fuck, I was so mad. Yeah, I called you. Like, I just got home from the airport, and you're like, what the fuck? I'm already in Las Vegas. I said, I lost my fucking car in the airport. Fuck.
You daffy broad.
I know it. I still do that shit, though.
All right. Now let's get back to that audiobook. I met Matt Becker in the local Phoenix comedy circuit. He was an odd duck. His jokes were out of the league of the boilerplate that everyone else was doing to amuse the dregs that free comedy attracted. But his confidence was shit. And he tended to give everyone the creeps, both in the audience and in the back of the room. He was the comedian's comedian's comedian, and we fell in love straight away. And by now, I'd been introduced to what they call triple gigs that were infamous at the time, and they're still legend. David Tribble was and still is a booker out of Washington State who ran a circuit of one-nighters all over the Northwest that was known for shit money and incomprehensible drives between shows. One night in Pocatello, Idaho, the next 7 hours to Billings, Montana, only to double back, the next night to Missoula. You'd make $125 plus hotel per night as an opening act, not including nights off. Having a drive from Arizona even to start the runs, you'd be lucky to break even. Who gives a fuck? I'm working on the road as a traveling stand-up comedian. I'm fucking girls with similar mullets. I'm driving through Yellowstone National Park between...